Welcome to the August podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The August issue is on the topic of minimally invasive spine surgery. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Rod Oskuyan of the Swedish Neuroscience Institute in Seattle, Washington, speaks with Dr. Andrew Grossbach of the University of Iowa. They discuss Dr. Grossbach and colleagues' article, Flexion Distraction Injuries of the Thoracolumbar Spine, Open Fusion versus Minimally Invasive Percutaneous Pedicle Screw Fixation.
This is Rod Oskuyan from the Swedish Neuroscience Institute in Seattle, and I have the distinct pleasure today to discuss a very interesting article that we had the pleasure to review and will be coming online in the August issue of the Neurosurgical Focus topic, which is minimally invasive spine surgery. Speaking on behalf of Dr. John James, Dr. Weiss, and Dr. Juan Uribe, who is one of the co-editors, we had such a response. I think it was the most submitted Neurosurgical Focus to date. You know, Juan and I were reading papers day and night, and we really had an excellent and international response to the topic. We had a difficult choice of choosing one, and Dr. Grossbach is actually on the line with us here today from the University of Iowa in Iowa City, and we'll go over his paper today. And Dr. Grossbach, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Both Dr. Uribe and myself found very interesting about your article is that for us, minimally invasive spine surgery is really taken off, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. And a lot of the things that we could not do through minimally invasive techniques, I think we're able to do today.
Yeah, I think minimally invasive spine surgery is a very exciting field. And I think that, you know, as people become more and more comfortable with the techniques, I think the indications and what we're able to do with minimally invasive surgery is really expanding. And in my paper, I kind of focus on the use of minimally invasive surgery for trauma. And I think that's a kind of a newer field in minimally invasive spine surgery, something that hasn't been written about as much as some of the other applications. But I think it's a very good use for minimally invasive surgery in certain situations. And so that's kind of what I wanted to try and highlight in my paper.
Would you say, just looking at the series, obviously it's not a large series, and to me the interesting topic was the fact that it was on flexion distraction injuries, which right. Historically in spine tend to be extremely unstable. Did you guys look at these injuries because of the instability associated with it?
Right, we did. What we try to look at it is, you know, an injury that it's a three-column injury and it is a very unstable injury. And, you know, we have, I think, 27 patients in our open series and 11 that we did with minimally invasive surgery. And we really tried to show that the way you can look at these flexion distraction injuries, even though there's that component of ligamentous injury in a vast majority of them, as long as you're able to really stabilize that using minimally invasive posterior instrumentation, if you allow that injury time to heal, you can have some very good results. And, you know, the ligamentous injury doesn't heal as fast as a bony injury. And so the amount of time that you need to keep that instrumentation in place before considering removal is certainly up for debate. And in our series, we like to keep it at least a minimum of a year before we discuss, you know, possibly removing that instrumentation. But it really hasn't been reported on very much before. And so that's why we kind of became interested in it and wanted to kind of look into it a little bit further.
The other interesting thing, you know, when we were reviewing the paper, and you can elaborate on this some more, is that it seems to me, at least, you know, in spine surgery, there's very few prospective studies like this in comparing two different techniques. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the prospective nature of it, as well as how these patients were followed, and then also surgically how the surgeon decided which technique to use, open versus MIS?
Sure. Yeah, I think in series like this, it is always difficult to try and get that prospective look at whatever you're researching. For our patients, you know, there are certainly a lot of things that went into deciding if a patient was going to be an open surgery or a minimally invasive surgery. You know, certainly there are limitations to minimally invasive surgery. And so patients with complete spinal cord injuries, or if they had some neurologic injury that needed open decompression, you know, obviously those weren't patients that we were able to treat with minimally invasive techniques. And so a lot of the specifics of the injury kind of dictated which approach we were able to use. But in the patients that were neurologically intact and we were able to stabilize with minimally invasive techniques, then we tried to do that in the cases when we were able to do that.
And what was the protocol? Did all patients get CT scans and MRIs before the surgeon decided which technique to use, or did some patients get MRIs versus CT scans?
Our protocol is to get CT scans on all these patients first, and then also get non-contrast MRI scans. And that allows us to evaluate the bony anatomy kind of better with the CT scan for preoperative planning, looking at the pedicles and sizing the screws. And then with the MRI, you know, that allows us to look at the neural elements and see if there's anything that needs to be decompressed, and then also look at the ligaments, and specifically in these type of injuries, that posterior ligamentous complex, and see the extent of injury.
And in terms of follow-up, Dr. Grossbach, these patients were seen at regular intervals post-op. Can you just discuss the follow-up? And then also, how about all the people that are opposed to MI surgery who say these sort of highly unstable fractures need to have a bony fusion, there needs to be a significant amount of traditional surgical approaches performed, such as decorticating of facet joints, putting in autografts? Can you discuss a little bit about the follow-up, and then also to the opponents who basically say that these type of injuries need to be done open regardless of the MRI and neurological status of the patient?
Sure. So for follow-up, typically what we do is we'd see the patient back at 6 weeks is kind of our standard post-operative follow-up. And then we really like to follow them closely for, like I said, up to at least a year. And so see them at either like 3 to 6 months and then see them back at a year. In a majority of our minimally invasive cases, we left that instrumentation in place. If it's not causing them problems, we leave that instrumentation in place. And two of our patients, we held discussions with them after a year, let things heal. And for one reason or another, if they had opted to have their instrumentation removed. And, you know, that certainly is an area of debate. One is you need that posterior lateral fusion, the bony fusion. And two, if you don't do the bony fusion, if you do the minimally invasive pedicle screws, how long do you leave those in before it's safe to take out? And like I discussed before, the ligamentous injury, it doesn't heal as fast as the bony injury. And like I said, in our case, we like wait for at least a year, and then at that point can have that discussion with the patient, talk about the risks of another surgery to remove that instrumentation, talk about the possible benefits, maybe getting that motion segment back, and then it's really a discussion to decide whether or not to remove that instrumentation. Regarding the need for a bony fusion, I think our average follow-up was around a year for all our patients, but really that long-term follow-up is definitely needed, so I don't think that the debate is settled by any means. And I think that we're going to need to follow these patients for much longer and, you know, see if down the road they run into, you know, increasing kyphosis or other problems. And so I definitely think that the debate's not over. We need to continue to follow these patients and keep a close eye on them. But I do think that trauma in particular is a kind of a unique entity, because really your goal for surgery is to kind of stabilize the injured area until it's able to heal. And so when you're talking about doing surgery for degenerative things where you're trying to fuse a motion segment, that's a different entity than have an injury and the main goal is to stabilize that injury until it's able to heal. And so I think minimally invasive surgery is very well suited for that goal, to stabilize that injured area, allow it time to heal. Once that bony healing and hopefully the ligamentous healing occurs, and then you shouldn't need that posterior lateral fusion, that you shouldn't need that bony fusion.
The exciting thing, I think, about your paper is that it was prospective. It was a 10-year study, and these patients were followed. And although the follow-up was short, it's about a year, I do think even though you had more patients in the open treatment group versus the MIS group,
right.
To me, the exciting thing is that I've actually done cases like this as well. I've done a few flexion distraction injuries that just needed to be realigned in posterior instrumentation. Patients that were not as healthy could not tolerate kind of a traditional open procedure. And to me, it's very exciting because for the first time we have evidence, and again, although small, with short follow-up, that minimally invasive spine surgery can be used for these very unstable injuries. and that good results can be obtained. And to me, that's one of the exciting things that you guys clearly demonstrate. And as you pointed out yourself, certainly there needs to be a longer follow-up. But again, being able to treat a patient with a multi-system trauma, got multiple comorbidities, a lot of times these patients they're coagulopathic, they've got head injury, to be able to do a minimally invasive surgery and get these people off the table and stabilize and mobilize them, you know, in post-op if they want, I think makes a difference. Did you guys see that in that group? I know you specifically obviously didn't look at some of the complications associated with deep venous thrombosis or some of the other things that are associated with. When we reviewed it, obviously the operative blood loss you guys looked at as well as the shorter operative time. What's your sense on the comparing the two groups? Are they able to mobilize quicker postoperatively?
Yeah, and I think prior studies have definitely shown that minimally invasive spine surgery, you usually get shorter operative times, less blood loss, shorter hospitalizations, and that's all things that we noticed, you know, in our group. But we had a definitely significantly lower blood loss in the minimally invasive group, and then we had a trend towards shorter operative times as well as shorter hospital stays. And like you had alluded to, that these injuries, flexion distraction injuries, are rarely isolated injuries. They oftentimes come from pretty high-speed, you know, motor vehicle accidents or other high-impact trauma. And so there's very frequently associated injuries, head trauma, intra-abdominal injuries that go along with these injuries. And so if you're able to use minimally invasive techniques and minimize blood loss, shorten operative times, hopefully minimize recovery, I think that bodes very well for those types of patients in particular.
Back in 1948, when Chance first described this flexion injury that was associated with the vertebral body, it really is a flexion distraction injury. So although ligamentous in the amount of disruption that there is of the posterior complex, it really is a fracture through bony structures. Wouldn't you agree with that, Dr.
Yeah. Lefra? Absolutely, I would. I think that classically this is described as a bony injury involving all three columns. And in our series, all of our patients did have disruption of that posterior ligamentous complex, but they have fracture in the anterior two columns, whether it be a compression-type fracture or a burst-type fracture. And so there's a large component of these injuries that are bony in nature. And so our goal is to allow that bony injury to heal and then as well as give the ligamentous injury hopefully time to heal as well.
So really, then, these sort of injuries, and I think you guys discussed this, is that it does include the patients having burst fractures, potentially, and compression fractures. And one of the things I think clearly that's seen in this injury is the amount of kyphosis that's present, even when these are fixed immediately. Our experience, and I think you guys described this in your follow-up, is that there is some kyphosis that occurs. And I think just to kind of point this out, but you guys saw this as well, Dr. Grossbach, would you agree with that?
Yeah, so typically in this type of injury, initially you see usually some kyphotic deformity. And, you know, our goal with surgery is to try and reduce that kyphotic deformity as back to close to normal alignment as possible, and then to try and prevent that kyphosis from happening over time. It's fairly common with traumatic injuries, especially ones that involve all three columns, that over time kyphotic deformity tends to get worse. And we actually had one patient in our series that refused surgery, did not want surgery. He was treated with bracing, and we saw over time his kyphotic deformity worsened. And, you know, we also saw in our surgical groups that even though they were instrumented both in the open and the minimally invasive groups, that over time kyphosis does tend to worsen. We didn't see a significant difference between our groups, between the open and minimally invasive groups, but that's always something that needs follow-up and can become a problem over time.
One last subject I'd like to discuss with you, although you didn't mention this in the paper, did you guys brace any patients? And if so, what's the practice of braces used in these injuries in your institution?
Mm-hmm. So postoperatively, we do brace all the patients, the open patients as well as the minimally invasive group. And we typically use standard TLSO brace, and we have them wear it for about 3 months postoperatively, and have them wear it when they're out of bed, when they're moving around.
So all the patients in this study that were treated surgically and the one that was treated non-operatively all got braced for 3 months as well?
Right, correct. Yep.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you spending time with us today, and
absolutely.
We're very excited to both see the final version of your paper, as well as looking forward to see the other papers that are coming out this August. And I just want to thank you and the rest of your group there at the University of Iowa for submitting what I think is a seminal paper in these type of injuries. We appreciate your group's efforts, and thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me.
This concludes our podcast for the August issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the September issue, when the topic will be Advances in the Neurosurgical Treatment of Intractable Pain. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter, and now also on Facebook.